Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Collin Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. As the country continues to expand its domestic fuels production, natural resource extraction-related development and infrastructure may be moving closer to northwest New Mexico's Chaco Canyon and the many nearby tribal communities. Residents, archaeologists, and advocates are questioning the encroachment. Who is benefiting and who is harmed by the oil and gas development, and how? Is the extraction worth any risks that may be posed? How can we strike a balance between modern-day energy needs, healthy communities, and the preservation of ancient sites? Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues are Victoria Barr, Farmington Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, District Manager. Also joining me is Eric Schlenker-Goodrich, the Executive Director of the Western Environmental Law Center, who joins us by phone from Taos, New Mexico. Welcome to both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Eric.
At the bottom of the hour, we'll also be joined by Lori Goodman, a resident of Northwest New Mexico and the director of Diné Citizens Against Ruining Our Environment, or Diné Care. Today's program is part of our Drilling Deep series, exploring natural gas drilling in the burgeoning oil industry in Northwest New Mexico. Reporter Laura Paskus's work in the series can be found on the KUNM website under News and then Drilling Deep. To participate in our program, email us at callinshow@kunm.org or post your questions and comments online at kunm.org. Victoria Barr, let's start by having you describe generally the BLM's role in New Mexico, please.
Good morning. Yeah, the BLM has been around for a long time, and we manage public lands in several states out west. And that there was a law passed in 1976 called the Federal Land Management Policy Act, which mandates us to have a mission of multiple use with sustained yield on these public lands. So that could range from anything from wild horse and burrow management to managing for healthy habitats, cultural resources, which would include archaeological sites, traditional cultural properties, recreation, national land conservation system areas. And we like to think of it as a system of public lands for the benefit and enjoyment of the American public.
So the role may vary throughout the state or even within, you know, one portion of the state then, depending upon the activity that you're looking to regulate?
Correct. In some areas, we have resources that are utilized for certain purposes, such as in the Farmington area, there's oil and gas resources that we are charged with managing for those public land resources and subsurface mineral estates. In other districts, grazing might be a significant resource that's managed for, but we like to balance the management of those resources within the sphere of our mission.
Now, I've talked about our concerns for northwestern New Mexico, and you're with the Farmington District Office. What are some other communities up in that area, just so people listening can get a sense of the area that we're talking about?
Sure. Well, there's Farmington itself, and then the surrounding cities of Aztec and Bloomfield. And then to the south, we have some communities around Lybrook and Counselor that are being more impacted by the latest development for the applications that we're receiving.
All right. Now, how is the BLM involved with oil and gas development in Northwest New Mexico?
Okay. So Congress and federal laws say that we should make available to leasing several areas of public lands and subsurface minerals. And so we, every year or every so often, put available leases up, and different entities will bid on those leases for those subsurface mineral rights, oil and gas, for example. Then once they get those leases, they primarily have a right to that material under federal law.
For how long? How long does a lease last?
It depends. Some of the leases that were leased out several years ago, 40 years ago, might still be active. Other leases are, the newer ones are usually for a 5-year period or a 10-year period, and they have within that amount of time to develop that lease. So once that leasing happens, they have a right to develop it. The process is, once the lease happens and they decide they want to develop it, they submit to us an application for a permit to drill, or known as an APD. Then once we receive the APD, that goes under an extensive review process, including compliance with the National Environmental Policy Act and the appropriate level of analysis before we issue any permit. And in that process, we try to reduce impacts to the surface to various things such as cultural resources, wildlife, soils, and we analyze these things pretty intensively before deriving a decision.
All right, so really looking to be a steward of the activities that happen there.
Absolutely.
All right, Eric Schlenker Goodrich, probably something that comes to mind for many of our listeners who don't live in northwest New Mexico but who've been to that part of the state, is Chaco Canyon and perhaps other archaeological sites in that part of the state. Are we talking about oil and gas development near Chaco Canyon?
Yeah, absolutely. And as a broader context, the San Juan Basin has been subject to both oil and gas development and coal exploitation for decades, over 50 years. So this is a basin that really, from our perspective, has been turned into a sacrifice zone. And that's a huge problem. Chaco Canyon is, of course, at the heart of it. It is an icon for New Mexico in terms of its cultural resources. One thing that I would emphasize is that Chaco Canyon and the cultural area, it's not just the park itself. It is the broader landscape around Chaco Canyon, that broader area that holds immense cultural values. And the other point I would make on this is that it's not just about Chaco Canyon, it's also about the living communities in those areas. There are a lot of Navajo people. Hopefully, Lori Goodman will be on the phone in a little while. There are a lot of living peoples in these areas who are impacted by fossil fuels, in particular from a public health perspective.
Well, now, one thing you just mentioned, and what I wanted to bring up is, you know, during last week's call-in show, there was discussion about the dependency of New Mexico's economy on the oil and gas industry. So hasn't there been oil and gas development in this state for some time? So what, if anything, has changed or is changing?
Well, absolutely. Oil and gas development is very significant in New Mexico. New Mexico is a dominant state for oil production as well as natural gas production. San Juan Basin has historically been focused on natural gas production. And the drilling that we are witnessing now around Chaco Canyon is a little bit different. It is shale oil drilling. So we are drilling for oil development, and that is being facilitated by new technologies dealing with fracking, which, of course, are very controversial and hold immense risks to the environment.
Now, is the new development happening according to a plan?
I think Victoria will have a different perspective on this, but from our perspective, absolutely not. The BLM is currently allowing further leasing and drilling around Chaco Canyon under the pretext that they authorized it back in 2003 through what's called a resource management plan. The problem with that is that the 2003 resource management plan was focused on coal bed methane development. It was not focused on shale oil extraction around Chaco Canyon. And that drilling, those drilling technologies and those drilling practices are very distinct from what was addressed in 2003 by BLM. So there is no resource management plan governing the orderly and efficient development of shale oil production in this area, and that's an immense problem. And so what's happening here is you have a basic three-stage process, and the way it should work is that BLM develops a comprehensive plan for how oil and gas resources will be developed and how you will protect the broader landscape. Second, they then go through a leasing process. And third, they then approve drilling permits to allow lessees to exercise their rights. The problem here is that BLM has it inverted, and they're creating a train wreck. They concede that they have to go through a planning process for shale oil development, and that planning process is underway. That's wonderful. We applaud that. But at the same time they're doing that, they continue to try to lease new lands around Chaco Canyon and to approve applications for permit to drill. So drilling is underway. If you've driven out along 550 towards Chaco Canyon, you've seen all the drilling rigs in that area. It is turning into an industrial zone, despite the fact that BLM has no plan in place to govern how that is to proceed. And now they're trying to expand that development through the Chaco pipeline, which will allow them to quadruple the amount of production in the area.
I'm talking with Victoria Barr, Farmington Bureau of Land Management, or BLM District Manager, and Eric Schlenker Goodrich, the Executive Director of the Western Environmental Law Center. And we're talking about oil and gas development in northwest New Mexico. You can post comments and questions for our panel on Facebook. Search for KUNM Radio or on Twitter at KUNM News. And Victoria, you want to respond a little bit to a few things Eric said?
Sure. I would say in response, we have actually made the decision to defer leasing within a 10-mile buffer right now around the Chaco Canyon Historic Park. And that it totals about 20,601 acres. Older leases or active leases that intersect the 10-mile buffer around Chaco Canyon total about 64,950 acres. The majority of the land around Chaco Canyon Historic Park is tribal land or Indian allotment land or tribal trust land, which is split estate. The BLM does not lease those areas for mineral extraction. That is done by a different federal agency, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Federal Indian Management Office. Also, in terms of the cultural landscape and the archaeological resources, we're mandated by Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act to identify and mitigate for adverse effects of properties or archaeological resources or cultural resources that could have an adverse effect and that are eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Essentially, what that means is we consult with the State Historic Preservation Office, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, tribal communities, tribal governments, other archaeologists, literature. We do on-the-ground research to identify these types of properties and then to come up with a mitigation plan. So I think to say that we're destroying archaeological resources is not exactly what's happening. We mitigate for the adverse effects. And very often that's avoidance.
All right. Now, I'm curious, why did the BLM defer granting leases in that buffer zone? What was behind that decision?
That decision, I wasn't here at the time, but my understanding is that decision was a result of concerns over the effects to the Chalkland landscape.
Now, Eric, you're with the Western Environmental Law Center. We've talked, somewhat about the procedural issues under what's required under certain federal laws. What are the environmental issues? What makes this development that we're seeing up there, this new development, problematic from an environmental standpoint?
Well, with the Chaco area, the buffer, it was certainly appreciated in terms of drilling around that area, but the resources, the cultural resources, extend far beyond that. And to surround an icon for cultural resources with industrial development does not exactly help protect that area as much as we think needs to be done. This is an area, it's world-class archaeological resources and cultural resources, and those are cultural resources that Pueblo people and the Navajo people have deep roots in, and they live around this broader area. And when you think, I alluded to this before, but when you look at some of the broader issues implicated by oil and gas development in this area, you have huge public health concerns. This is an area, again, that is a fossil fuel sacrifice zone. Yet no federal agency has ever done any comprehensive public health assessment of what the impacts of those fossil fuels have been to the communities in that area. There's also nowadays, back in 2003 when BLM completed its resource management plan, they punted on the issue of climate change. They said that, well, we don't know how to address this, so we're not going to address it. Nowadays, we know that climate change is very real. It's happening now. It's impacting these lands as we speak. In fact, there are numerous studies that show that climate change disproportionately impacts communities in the San Juan Basin, in particular the native peoples in those areas. And just recently, there was a study that came out that showed that over the San Juan Basin is a methane hotspot, the largest concentration of methane emissions in the United States. And methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. It's 86 times as potent as carbon dioxide over a 20-year time period. And in the San Juan Basin, that's a huge problem. And methane is, importantly, not just a greenhouse gas, it is an energy resource. It's the primary ingredient of natural gas. So what we are witnessing in the San Juan Basin is the emission of huge plumes of natural gas, of energy into the atmosphere that is contributing to climate change, and at the same time is not producing energy for use by homes, schools, and businesses. That's a big problem. And what it indicates to us is that there are very sloppy practices underway in the oil and gas fields in the San Juan Basins, San Juan Basin, which is precisely why the agency needs BLM to go through this planning process.
So environmentally, we're seeing issues. Is there a waste issue as well in this regard with regard to our natural resources?
Yeah, absolutely. The methane, again, is the primary ingredient of natural gas. So all this natural gas being released into the atmosphere is a waste of the energy resource, the precise energy resource that BLM purports to want to develop.
Right.
And so that waste of energy is huge. It's not just a waste of energy, but it's also a waste of royalties to our government.
We're discussing the impact of oil and gas development in northwestern New Mexico today. I'm joined by Victoria Barr, Farmington Bureau of Land Management, or BLM District Manager, and Eric Schlenker-Goodrich, the Executive Director of the Western Environmental Law Center, who joins us by phone from Taos, New Mexico. Join the conversation at 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866. Tell us, do you support oil and gas development in New Mexico? Why? We'll be back with you after this short break.
Support for KUNM comes from the Motion Picture Association's WhereToWatch.com, celebrating award season by helping film and television fans find the movies and TV shows they love. WhereToWatch.com. It's not every year that Valentine's Day falls on Saturday. The NM Phil invites everyone to make a night of it. February 14th, it's a perfect Valentine at Popejoy Hall. Music, the language of love, will fill the air, from Romeo and Juliet to Les Mis, and many more. Conducted by John Morris Russell, with soprano Jennifer Perez and tango dancers on stage. 6 p.m. Saturday the 14th at Popejoy Hall. Information at nmphil.org. A message from the tax-exempt New Mexico Philharmonic.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're talking about the impacts of oil and gas development in northwestern New Mexico, in Chaco Canyon and the Chaco Canyon, Chacoan landscape. I'm joined by Victoria Barr, the Farmington Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, District Manager, and Eric Schlenker-Goodrich, the Executive Director of the Western Environmental Law Center, who joins us by phone from Taos, New Mexico. Thanks also to both of you for being here. And Victoria, we heard from Eric just before the break. Is there anything you'd like to say in response?
Oh, sure. So right now, the BLM is actively addressing the concerns over venting and flaring, as well as the methane issue. For venting and flaring and gas, we are looking at developing some further regulations regarding onshore order number 9. And actually, we have a scientist who works for us on the district that is actively on that team to help further develop those regulations to deal with the issue of venting and flaring and gas and leak detection. Also in the district, we are fortunate enough to have been able to expend significant resources in purchasing an infrared camera. And we have some highly trained folks there that go around and they inspect operations to look for methane leak detections. And when those are discovered, they're immediately dealt with the proponent. In terms of the methane, yeah, that's I think a concern we can all appreciate. There's a couple different issues at hand. It's not clear what the exact cause is. For example, there's areas of the country where we have much greater amounts of oil and gas development that don't have this type of methane issue that we're seeing over the San Juan Basin. A few scientists think that the Fruitland outcrop of coal, which is a naturally occurring part of the landscape, actually emits naturally a lot of methane gas.
I think I was looking at a BLM handout, or maybe it was by someone else, about flaring. Because of fracking, nitrogen is injected into the ground, and the crude oil that comes from that is too nitrogen rich, and so the nitrogen has to be bled off, and that could possibly be creating problems as well. Is that not correct?
Well, so the flaring actually, instead of letting those gases and things naturally evaporate, the flaring mitigates the types of gases that go into the atmosphere. So it's actually a benefit to have it flared rather than just to let it sit and naturally evaporate. And flaring is also temporary. The average flare time is 7 to 9 days. If it goes beyond a certain point, we do have regulatory authority to begin charging royalties to those companies because we do want them to get product out to the market. And it is money lost for the United States government to have flaring beyond a certain point.
All right, let's let Eric, and if you'd comment briefly before we get to some comments and calls, please.
Yeah, Victoria, unfortunately, and with all due respect, it's simply wrong that we don't know the sources of the methane emissions. If you look at the methane hotspot study, it identifies and quantifies where those methane emissions come from. Of 370,000 total metric tons of methane, approximately 330,000 tons is traced to San Juan Basin oil and gas development. And that's confirmed when you take a look at US EPA greenhouse gas reporting data. And if you crunch that data for the San Juan Basin, it shows that around 14.5% of all directly vented methane in the entire United States comes directly from oil and gas development in the San Juan Basin. So we know where this comes from. We know how to fix it. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that we're saying, hey, slow down, put a moratorium in place on further development in this area, pending development of a resource management plan, to make sure that you can address both cultural resource issues as well as air quality and public health issues, and you can deal with this methane problem. It's one thing to say, hey, we're trying to do something about it. It's another to actually do something about it, and that's not what is happening in the San Juan Basin at this moment.
All right, let me go ahead and read a Twitter comment from Jim, who writes that he worked near Chaco when a pipeline was put in, and he says BLM turned a blind eye and resources were destroyed. Here's his follow-up question. What proportion of comments to BLM have been against drilling and pipelines? And I know you received an inordinate amount of comments about a particular pipeline, the Pinon pipeline, but what proportion of comments have been against the pipelines?
I haven't had an opportunity to review the comments we just received, but I think it's important to note that because of the land status out there, you know, we have state land, we have Indian allotted land, we have private land. Not all the development is occurring on BLM land. You know, I think we can all agree that we need as a country to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. If we can produce it on public lands, BLM lands, we have regulatory mechanisms to ensure that that's happening in a way that we can mitigate for environmental effects. I don't know if the gentleman's pipeline that he observed was on public land or another administrated land, but I know that when we do process things like pipelines, we do extensive environmental studies. For example, right now with the Pinon pipeline for the portions that are on BLM land, so for the pipeline only, 15.46% of that pipeline crosses BLM, 31.14% crosses tribal, 47% is private, and 6% is state.
All right, and we'll get back to talking about that specific pipeline, but let's go ahead and bring in our first caller of the day. It's Mike from Albuquerque. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine, and you today?
I'm doing great. You know, I'm glad you're talking about this, and I just wanted to express that I'm opposed to extraction of oil and gas. As your representative from the BLM said, we have adverse impacts of our dependence on foreign oil, but our dependence on oil and gas overall, we know that there's a safe limit to what we can burn and not be affected by climate change catastrophically. And unfortunately, there's about five times as much oil and gas and fossil fuel in the ground as what's safe to burn. And we're not just talking about a threat to Chaco and our native communities. We're talking about the number one threat to national security, according to the Pentagon, being climate change. And here in New Mexico, we're talking about drier conditions, hotter conditions if we continue down this road of dependence on fossil fuel. So I just think that it's time to switch to some renewable alternatives. I know tomorrow at UNM at noon, a whole bunch of students and community members are going to gather to call on the university to divest its portfolio from fossil fuels. And I think that's an important step here.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for your call. And Victoria, I wanted to ask you, is BLM now considering a climate change perspective to any of the actions that it takes or is proposing or supporting?
Well, there was recent case law that upheld our air quality analysis in our 2003 RMP that was decided by the Interior Board of Land Appeals. And essentially that case law stated that the air quality analysis was adequate or sufficient according to law for what we're analyzing now in this area. Also, the EIS will have more specific language on
EIS,
climate
change. Environmental impact statement.
Sorry, yeah.
That's okay. The
environmental impact statement that's being prepared for the resource management plan amendment.
And Eric, you want to comment a little bit? I know we talked about climate change a bit before, but what do you think the level of concern about climate change ought to be on BLM's part at this point and other government agencies?
And it's dramatic. I mean, both in terms of addressing the issues of climate change relative to the San Juan Basin and the people of the San Juan Basin. As I mentioned, the impacts of climate change to native communities and the people in rural areas are disproportionately high. And BLM has an opportunity here both to address the impacts of climate change and to try to mitigate those impacts, in particular by not allowing further oil and gas drilling and fracking in this area, but also, as I mentioned, by keeping that methane out of the atmosphere. That methane, by the way, just to put it into context, is equivalent to the greenhouse gas emissions emitted by 6 million cars per year. That's natural gas. That natural gas can be put in the pipeline. It can be used by homes, schools, and businesses. And we certainly need to start pushing forward with transitioning away from fossil fuels towards clean energy and energy efficiency as rapidly as possible. There's a big disconnect between what happens on the ground with BLM decision-making on oil and gas, but also with coal, and then what President Obama says in Washington, D.C., that we need to really address the climate change issue. Over time, I think that what is happening in Washington, D.C. in terms of policy development on climate change will percolate down to the field level and BLM's Farmington field office, and we're certainly going to work to try to speed that process. And BLM is obliged to consider climate change through its NEPA analysis. Now, as Victoria mentioned, some of those air quality analyses may have been upheld, but those air quality analyses did not deal specifically with climate change, not at the level that we think needs to be done. And
All right.
That will be an issue that we press aggressively.
And Victoria, you want to respond briefly before before we get to our next caller?
Yeah, just briefly. I just wanted to mention, too, that BLM New Mexico is actively involved with a group of other government agencies as well as universities where we're collaboratively looking at the methane issue. And there were opposing theories scientifically as to the cause of the methane.
All right, let's go ahead and go to our next caller. It's Brooke from Taos. Good morning, Brooke.
Thank you for letting me be online, and thank you to Eric and to Victoria. I just kind of want to go kind of quick here, but there was a new water pipeline that was put in near Chaco Canyon a couple years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago. I've always wondered, where did that water come from? How is it being acquired? And if we could just say exactly how much water is being used or approximately for each fracking event so that everyone becomes kind of aware of that? And is that water useful, or can humans use that water after the fracking event for farming or drinking, whatever? I want to know what happens to the water after the fracking event. If it is polluted, how did it become polluted? And then where is that polluted water stored within that landscape? Is it open, closed? Then I'd like to know about also just on kind of, so I'd like to hear about the water. And then lastly, Chaco's renowned internationally for its night skies. It's a UNESCO site. It has a bunch of other distinctions. When we were last there, because of the abundance of new fracking wells in the area, and this has been 3 years now, it was already noticeable that the night skies are being deteriorated from light pollution, because everywhere they put a fracking well has a pretty large light, kind of baseball field, football field type light that's on pretty much 24/7. And so when we talked to the rangers about that, they said that they were pretty concerned about the deterioration of the night sky already 3 years ago. When we talked to tourists in the area, there's all kinds of international tourists visiting Chaco Canyon about what was going on outside the park. They were pretty surprised and shocked. And so I just, you know, if the word could get out a little bit more about this, I think that this is a really incredible resource that we have in New Mexico. And having been going there regularly over the last 10 years, it's been pretty alarming and shocking to see how quickly a place that has remained basically untouched for thousands of years is being changed very quickly in about 10 years. And I think those fracking wells and those leases, as we Victoria mentioned, a lease today is usually only good for about 5 years. So it's a very short-term project for what I can see. And from what has been said today, it sounds like the benefits from that aren't even really truly benefiting New Mexicans, other than the short-term employment that's coming to the area. But often the people who do the fracking jobs are contractors who are
All right, Brooke, let me go ahead. We've talked about a number of things, and let's go ahead. Thank you for your call today. Let's bring in our third guest who's on the phone. It is Lori Goodman. She is director of Dene Care, Dene Citizens Against Ruining Our Environment. She joins us by telephone from Northwest New Mexico. Good morning, Lori, and I'm guessing you heard that call from Brooke.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and so tell us, just so we know, what community do you live up there, and how close are you to Chaco Canyon, just because that's one of our reference points for this discussion?
Okay, our members are from the impacted chapters, Encino, Counselor, and just the area up around there. So that's who we are made up.
All right. And how close are you or those communities to the Chaco Canyon area that people might be familiar with?
Okay. The land, I guess it's jurisdictional. It's, you know, county land, you know, it's checkerboard area.
Right.
So, you know, I think the closest is like a mile away.
Okay, so relatively close. So now you heard Brooke's call, and she had two issues she was mainly concerned with, which and a third one at the end, but mainly the water being used for fracking, and then the night skies and the light pollution. Would you like to address either of those as a resident of the area and how that's impacting you?
Well, the area is a rural area, and what the local residents have talked about is the flaring. You know, it's like a huge city area. It's all lit up, you know, at night. So that's a real concern. And then the other is the impacts to the water. And this being a desert area, and then the contamination, those are huge concerns that people have.
Now, Brooke also talked about the water being used for fracking and wondering what happens to it. Eric, is that something that you can address?
Yeah, Victoria might be able to address some of the specifics a little bit better.
All right, let's
water management.
Let me let her jump in first, then Eric.
Sure, thank you. So the the operators out there right now, they're trying to recycle as much water as they can from one operation to another. In terms of the pipeline that Brooke was mentioning, I'm not sure if that was on BLM or another land administrator's area or private land even. But in terms of the water, these companies are actually right now trying to extract water that is down about 4,000 feet to use in their operation rather than using potable water or drinking water. This water that they're using is very mineral laden. It's not something that we could consume. And also they're trying to recycle water so that there's a less dependence on using water that you and I would need.
The water that can't be recycled, what happens to that? Is it in open pits?
Those go into injection wells.
Okay.
And so there's been extensive studies, too, on the geology of the basin, and our geology is lending itself to stabilization when these operations occur. We're not seeing the tectonic activity that you have in some areas of the country associated with injection wells. The companies are really trying to come up with better methods to reduce the impacts to the environment. As we said, the flaring is a temporary thing. They're working on technologies to even reduce the visual components of flaring. Last week, I had the great opportunity to go out to Chaco Canyon Historic Park, and we met with the Park Service for about 3 days. And on my way out there, I actually drove out there at nighttime off Highway 550 and actually didn't see that evening any flaring. It was very dark, and we were able to enjoy a dark sky experience at the park last week.
All right. While we're talking about fracking, I want to read an email comment from Katie, who asks, what about earthquakes around fracking? How is BLM mitigating those impacts on Chaco Canyon and I presume other sites?
Yeah, we really haven't seen any seismic activity. Nothing's been reported to us by USGS. If you go to usgs.gov, there's actually a link that monitors earthquake activity across the country. And so it'll show spots where you have earthquakes occurring over a magnitude of 2. And it doesn't show anything for this area. We haven't received reports of earthquakes in this area, so it's not something that we're addressing right now. And there is a pretty extensive geological study done that people can go to our website to view, blm.gov/New Mexico, and then just navigate to the Farmington page. And it's a hydrological assessment of the geology around here. And what the geologists are really kind of saying is this isn't an area where we would see that type of earthquake activity associated with fracking.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's Teresa from Acoma Pueblo. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Thank you for joining us. And you had some questions or comments for our panel today.
Yes, my concern comes from my own experience in working with various tribes here in New Mexico. I served as the former historic preservation officer for the Pueblo of Acoma, and so have some familiarity with this specific Chaco project. But what I'd like to know, and what I'd like for the listeners to hear on your show, is what outside of this formal EIS process, the environmental impact study, is BLM doing to address the cultural concerns from the tribes and Pueblos that have a relationship to Chaco, and to really understand the depth of the environmental, the cultural, even the spiritual connection that these tribes have to what we know is a living landscape.
Sure, that's a great question. So what we're doing right now for both the environmental impact statement and all of our other type of NEPA documents, and just part of my job, is we're reaching out to these Native communities. I'm scheduling meetings with various tribal governments and chapter houses. On my staff, I have a full-time Native American coordinator who's fluent in Navajo, and she regularly attends chapter house meetings to discuss BLM projects with them. It's very important to me that we do complete those consultations with our Native communities, and also we are directed to do that by executive orders in Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act to work with tribes to identify areas of religious and or cultural significance. And then we work on developing mitigations for those areas.
Well, let me just remind our listeners, we're talking today about the impacts of oil and gas development in Northwest New Mexico. I'm joined by Lori Goodman, a resident of Northwest New Mexico and the director of DNA Citizens Against Ruining Our Environment, or DNA Care. And Lori, I'm sure you'll want to comment. We're going to hold on to that for a minute. I'm also joined by Victoria Barr, the Farmington Bureau of Land Management, or BLM District Manager, and Eric Schlenker-Goodrich, the Executive Director of the Western Environmental Law Center. He joins us from Taos, New Mexico. You can join our conversation at 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866. We'll be back with some comments from our panelists and your calls and comments after this short break.
Western National Parks Association presents the Navajo Rug and Jewelry Show at the Petroglyph National Monument Visitor Center this Saturday and Sunday, February 14th and 15th, featuring a large selection of weavings and jewelry direct from Hubble Trading Post, with rug talks at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. and live weaving demonstrations daily. Information available at 899-0205 or WNPA.org. That's WNPA.org. A message from the tax-exempt Western National Parks Association.
If one of your New Year's resolutions is to get rid of that old car or truck that doesn't run anymore, that's one you can keep with one simple phone call. Annual proceeds from vehicle donations equal what we take in during one on-air pledge drive, so it's a very important source of income for KUNM. When you donate your unwanted vehicle, you're helping KUNM while helping yourself to check one off your list. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're talking about the impacts of oil and gas development in Northwest New Mexico. And Lori Goodman, I want to bring you into this conversation. We just heard from the BLM's Victoria Barr, and you're a resident of that area. You are a Native American. And, you know, we posted a link to comments that that your organization submitted regarding a proposed pipeline. And rather than talking about, you know, what BLM hasn't done, what is it that you need for BLM and other government agencies to do and to notice and to care for in your community?
Okay, first of all, I just want to make a correction that I'm not a resident there.
Okay.
I work with the residents there.
Okay.
Okay. Now, just listening to how the ideal world, how the process is supposed to be done through the NEPA process, is what I heard with the consultation and then meeting with at the chapters and everybody's informed. Let me tell you, that is not the case. We attended a meeting on December 11th at Ohuk Encino, and with BLM was there. And there we learned that BLM is only concerned with what happens on BLM land, and they do not know what other things that go on, and they were not aware of the social impacts, which is devastating with the influx of monies coming in, and the Navajo people not speaking English are made to sign over, you know, contracts and stuff that they don't understand. That's the reality that's happening out there. So in all of this, there have been several murders going on just because of the influx of monies. And also, when we were at the meeting on the 11th, there was an explosion that happened on the 8th, and BLM didn't even know about it. And these were the concerns that the people were bringing up. So it came out that BLM is only concerned in, you know, just oversees stuff that happens on BLM. If it didn't happen, you know, where we oversee, then, you know, it's somebody else's problem.
Well, and let's let Victoria comment, and then I want to get back to some of these social concerns. So and a caller. So go ahead, Victoria.
Sure. I mean, it's obviously concerning if these things are occurring. And, you know, and under our authorization, legally what we can do is regulate what happens on BLM. The Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Federal Indian Mineral Office, that's the entity that's responsible for the leasing and the surface activities on Indian allotted land. And so what we can do is tell the communities if they have an issue with what's happening on the IA land or tribal trust land is to contact their BIA office or the Federal Indian Minerals Office. And
is there collaboration between the BLM and the BIA? And now we're starting to get into a lot of initials here, but are government agencies working together in that area?
We work partly together, but we're also guided by different sets of regulations. The BLM regulations and the BIA have different authorities. And so we need to make sure that legally we're applying the appropriate authorities in the correct areas. But BIA is also promulgated, like BLM, to do consultation with the communities that they're serving.
All right, let's get to our next caller. It's Edmund from White Oaks, who has a follow-up question about citizen opposition and comments. Yes, go ahead, Edmund. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, it's a very good program. Thank you for it. I was just surprised the representative of the BLM was not familiar with the proportion of people who've contacted BLM to oppose further development in the Chaco region. She seems to be familiar with a lot of statistics, but didn't seem to have that at hand. It seems she should be aware of how many people are opposing this development.
All right, let's let Victoria comment. And Victoria, I think I saw a number like 7,400 comments regarding the Pinon pipeline.
Well, that was actually when we gave that data to you, that was a day before the comment period closed. Since then, we've received closer to 30,000 comments. Some of those are form letters. Some of those are individually written letters. And to read through that amount of mail, I'm sure you can understand that it takes some time for us to do that. So right now, I really couldn't say who's opposed, who's against. But we will evaluate all those. And it's not necessarily we tally up who's opposed, who's against when we make our decision, but that we weigh into our decision process. And also, you know, I think for the Pinon pipeline, I just want to reiterate, we're only authorizing the rights-of-ways on 15.46% of the main pipeline and on 32.97% of the gathering system. So the BIA will be authorizing roughly 31%. 47% goes through private land, and the company will need to obtain those rights away separately. So,
question for you, though. When will we know the proportion of comments opposing or in favor? When will you have that data available for people?
Well, sure. I can also answer a little bit of that, too, as well,
okay.
Kathleen.
Okay, go. Well, let me let Victoria and then Eric, you can jump in.
Yeah, I can talk about the process for us preparing the EA. So right now it's actually being drafted, and we're conducting our environmental studies. We're conducting the archaeological survey, the wildlife surveys. We have flagging out there in the proposed area. The company submitted to us what we call an SF-299 or an application for a right-of-way. It doesn't matter who submits one. We process it. There's no foregone conclusion as to what our decision will be. So right now that's being drafted. And this summer we will be releasing a draft environmental assessment for the public to further comment upon. In that draft environmental assessment, there will be a discussion about the comments we received during the scoping period. So that'll be available then.
Okay, that'll be in the summer. All right.
Right.
Let me let Eric comment at this point, and then we can get back. But I also want to get to Lori, too. So go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, a couple of quick points here. The vast majority of comments of those 30,000 were submitted by people who oppose the pipeline, and that's a result of fantastic organizing by groups like Lori's, Dene Care, as well as Wild Earth Guardians, San Juan Citizens Alliance, Center for Biological Diversity, the Rio Grande Chapter of the Sierra Club. So they've done fantastic work building resistance to this notion.
Hang on, Eric. We won't know that officially until the summer. All right, so right now we're just surmising?
We know by our own data from the action alerts that have been submitted by our organization. So we do have quantified data on that. I don't have the specific figures, but, for example, at least over 10,000 were achieved by Wild Earth Guardians action alerts. Now, an important thing on the public participation front is that BLM talks a really good game. The problem is that they have approved thus far over 100 drilling permits in this area without going through any sort of public review or participation. Instead, what they do is they prepare these cut-and-paste environmental assessments that have never been submitted to the public for review and comment. It's very difficult to even get these. We have a field organizer, San Juan Citizens Alliance has a field organizer, Mike Eisenfeld, who literally has to go and bird dog them virtually every day to try to find out, hey, have you issued a new drilling permit yet? And where is the environmental assessment for that? So it's very difficult to track what is going on. I congratulate BLM for opening the public process for the Chaco Piñon pipeline, but they only did that after we provided huge amounts of resistance saying you need to go through a very healthy, significant public review and participation process. They only did that after significant resistance was built by the community.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's John from Taos. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. My question or my comment or whatever is probably for Victoria, but the whole thing is this. She's breaking down how much BLM land is involved and how much tribal land and on and on and on. The point is, she is responsible for all federal land. It's not just BLM. Tribal land, for example, is federal land. It doesn't belong to the tribes. They've never taken fee simple interest in it because they don't want to have to pay taxes. That's a different story. But the point is, all that land up there, BLM, tribal, Forest Service, she's responsible for all of those drilling permits.
All right,
why break it down? Why obfuscate and say this much and that much? She's responsible for all of it.
All right, when you say she, I assume you mean BLM, but let's go ahead and let Victoria comment. Thanks for your call, John.
Well,
is that accurate?
Not exactly. Okay. So, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Federal Indian Management Office, they manage the surface of the Indian allotted, and they also manage the leasing. So, for example, they have leased the minerals for about 200 allotments. And then, so they had the leases. BLM regulates the downhole, or what's called like the subsurface stuff of the actual drilling. But the BIA does the surface analysis, the impact analysis, the community analysis, the cultural resource assessment, and that sort of thing. So, you know, I alluded to a little bit earlier about what agency is kind of authorized to do what. And so it's very clear in our regulations what we're authorized to do. So, I mean, I really don't have a say or a decision space for stuff that happens on Indian allotted lands. We do have a decision space for how the downhole stuff is regulated and to ensure that there's inspections and things happen to ensure there's not degradation of the pipelines or the drill holes. But the surface is very much managed by another agency.
All right, let's bring Lori back into the conversation just to shift a little bit, Lori, because you started to talk about the social impacts to communities up in the northwest part of the state because of this development. And if you want to just tell us a little more about what's being experienced up there, that would be great.
Okay, well, first of all, the roads are being ripped up. And I do want to say that we would be naive to, anybody would be naive to believe that BLM is saying it's all procedures and all this. And just as we just heard, it's all these different agencies. And for that reason, just for that reason, there needs to be more information put out to the public. And that is not happening and was not happening until the people came and demanded information. There was only going to be one meeting held, and we were told this is going to be an EA. And what we're saying is there needs to be an EIS done.
Now, Lori, tell us, I want to know specifically about the impact of money coming into the community and whether and people are experiencing wealth or not. Who is experiencing any wealth by this new development?
Well, first of all, we heard from the Navajo Nation that government that $72 million flown into the Northwest communities just last year. So this is an influx of money where the poverty rate is high, and so naturally, you know, you have there was an incident where a young step grandkids, you know, took their grandpa's money and killed them. So these kinds of things are happening. Or, you know, people are, you know, if the community people, some people find out somebody got funds and they're and they feel like they're entitled to it, they beat people up. So these are things that are happening and needs to be scrutinized, and that needs an EIS. So those are the kind of things that are happening over there. And, you know, it's just like, it's just turn a, you know, look elsewhere. And we're getting tired of hearing, okay, there's consultation. Well, we got to ask BLM on the 11th. Okay, what is your definition of consultation? And they said, oh, we call the Navajo Nation president. Well, that is not consultation. Navajo Nation president operates 300 miles away, and we let BLM know that they need to be consulting with the people whose lands are impacted, the people that live there. But they hide behind all this bureaucratic red tape, saying, oh, you know, we can only do this. Somebody else is responsible. We're not getting anywhere. But
no.
Meanwhile, the roads are being ripped up, the water's getting contaminated, and even and the people that live there have memory of, you know, other things that have happened in the past, and they're afraid of that. For instance, Blocker Canyon back in the 60s, I guess, you know, there was gas, you know, in one of the canyons, and it blew up. You know, it's like there's no oversight, and what the people want to know is, okay, what's your backup plan? Okay,
no.
What happens when, you know,
all right, Laurie,
of course, the clinic?
I just want to stop you there because we're running low on time, but and we hear the totality of your concerns, and I do want to refer people to a document that we have provided a link to on our website where all the totality of the concerns are outlined. Eric, let's start with you as a bit of a wrap-up. What do you want to see happen in the area? What's not happening? What will help protect and create a balance between ancient archaeological sites, healthy communities, and energy extraction?
BLM is doing part of the thing right, that they're going through a resource management planning process. But what they need to do in the interim is impose a moratorium on further development. They need to look before they leap. You wouldn't build a house before you had the architectural plans, but what BLM is doing is essentially that. They're drilling, they're leasing, they're building pipelines before they have that comprehensive plan in place. So they need to go through that process, and process dictates outcomes. And those outcomes are the health of the people in this area, the protection of cultural resources, protection of the climate, protection of public health. So they need to put that moratorium in place, they need to go through the planning process, and they need to engage in the public in a meaningful way. As Laurie alluded to, right now, public participation is often viewed as, you know, we disparagingly say that BLM considers comments and then ignores them. So they need to make that public process meaningful, they need to get out into the communities, and they need to stop the current drilling and leasing that's in place to give time for that to develop.
All right, and Victoria, as a wrap-up from you,
sure.
How would you respond briefly
to
Eric?
And I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And I think that what Eric was saying about listening to what people are saying, we have adjusted some of our course with expanding on additional public meetings. I'm expanding our outreach opportunities and our consultations. And we look forward to people calling us or looking on our website to answer their questions, BLM.gov.
All right. And Laurie, back to you. Just what do you want listeners to know about what's happening in the area? Laurie, are you with us? Laurie is no longer with us, I guess. Thanks to our guests, Danae Cares, Laurie Goodman, the Western Environmental Law Center's Eric Schlenker-Goodrich, and the BLM's Victoria Barr. You can find a podcast of this and other KUNM call-in shows online at KUNM.org. Jefferson White engineered the show today. Kaveh Movahed handled our phones. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. Funding for KUNM's Drilling Deep series comes from the New Venture Fund. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This is the KUNM call-in show on 89.9 KUNM, broadcasting live from the University of New Mexico.